From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Best-selling British novelist Martin Amis has written a new memoir about writing and being the son of a famous writer. His father, the late Kingsley Amis, wrote satirical novels and was known for a caustic sense of humor and curmudgeonly personality. Martin Amis watched his father lose his sense of humor, his gift for language, and his memory in the final stage of his life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two CDs. Broke Down features singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves. It was produced by guitarist Gerf Morlix, who has just released his own debut CD as a leader. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says Israel and the Palestinians have agreed to resume peace negotiations next week in Washington. Albright met today with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat. She said both leaders will come to Washington with their delegations. The talks are expected to focus on the final status of Jerusalem and the Palestinian territories, Jewish settlements, and Palestinian refugees. At least 10 people have been wounded in a day of violence in Kosovo. The violence started when attackers threw grenades into a market where Serbs were shopping. Local Serbs blame Kosovo Albanians for the attack. Jackie Rowland reports.
The violence in the Serb town of Gračanica was sparked off by a grenade attack at the marketplace. Local Serbs responded by stopping Albanian cars on the road through the town in search of the attackers. A number of vehicles were set on fire. The British military commander responsible for this part of Kosovo went to Gračanica to try to calm the situation. British troops say an angry crowd surrounded the commander, so his bodyguards opened fire, wounding three people. Gračanica is one of the few remaining Serb enclaves in Kosovo. Tensions have been raised in recent weeks by a series of killings of Serbs in the province. For NPR News, this is Jackie Rowland in Belgrade.
Microsoft has responded to the Justice Department's plan to split the giant software company in two. A company spokesman said the latest filing argues against various parts of the government breakup plan. A federal judge must now decide whether the breakup should be part of Microsoft's penalty for violating antitrust laws. At a time when more and more people are buying goods and services online, seven big companies are proposing new guidelines designed to protect consumers and make it easier for them to complain when they get bad service. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The proposal, which apparently rose out of businesses' frustration with government efforts to set global policy standards, would include an international system for resolving online disputes. At its core would be a third-party, non-binding arbitration system, giving consumers some recourse when they feel they've gotten a raw deal. Ron Plesser is a Washington, D.C. lawyer who helped coordinate the effort.
Just felt that unless we did something, like other debates like privacy, business would just fall in the defensive. And there was no reason to do it in this issue. All these companies want to protect consumers. There's no reason not to.
Companies that have already agreed to take part include AT&T, Microsoft, and AOL. The proposal would also require participating businesses to disclose terms of a sale and provide customers with clearly stated refund and return policies. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow lost 80 points today to close at 10,735. The Nasdaq lost 65 points to close at 3756. This is NPR News. Thousands of World War II veterans gathered in New Orleans today to celebrate the opening of the National D-Day Museum. Today's the 56th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, the first phase of the liberation of Europe from the Nazis. NFL star Ray Lewis testified today about what he saw at an Atlanta street brawl that left two people dead. His testimony came as part of a plea bargain in which murder charges against Lewis were dropped. Joshua Leves reports from member station WABE in Atlanta.
Lewis's testimony incriminated Reginald Oakley and Joseph Sweeting, his two friends who, until yesterday, were his co-defendants. He said he saw them fighting with several other people at a post-Super Bowl party January 31st, and although he did not see anyone stabbed, Lewis said Oakley and Sweeting had brought knives with them. The Baltimore Ravens linebacker insisted he did not attack anyone. He also contradicted the testimony of two previous witnesses for the prosecution, friends of the victims who had said they tried to break up the fight and were not a part of it. Lewis agreed to testify for the prosecution and plead to a misdemeanor charge of obstruction of justice in exchange for having the murder charges against him dropped. He'll serve 1 year's probation and plans to return to the field this fall. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
At the tobacco trial in Miami today, a financial expert testified that the U.S. tobacco industry is worth $157 billion. The jury is considering what punitive damages the nation's five biggest tobacco companies should pay to hundreds of thousands of Florida smokers who claim to suffer from smoking-related illnesses. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MassMutual Financial Group, a global diversified financial services organization with more than $200 billion in assets under management. MassMutual, the blue chip company.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Amis is a member of England's most famous writing families. He's best known for his novels Money, London Fields, and The Information. The last two were bestsellers in the States. His father, Kingsley Amis, is best known for his satirical novel Lucky Jim. Kingsley wrote social satires and was known for his caustic wit and curmudgeonly personality. He was knighted in 1990, 5 years before his death. Now Martin Amis has written a memoir about being a writer who is the son of a writer. It's called Experience. Let's start with a reading from the opening chapter.
I am a novelist trained to use experience for other ends. Why should I tell the story of my life? I do it because my father is dead now, and I always knew I would have to commemorate him. He was a writer, and I am a writer. It feels like a duty to describe our case. A literary curiosity, which is also just another instance of a father and a son. This will involve me in the indulgence of certain bad habits. Name-dropping is unavoidably one of them, but I've been indulging that habit in a way ever since I first said, Dad. I do it because I feel the same stirrings that everyone else feels. I want to set the record straight. So much of this is already public, and to speak for once without artifice, though not without formality. The trouble with life, the novelist will feel, is its amorphousness, its ridiculous fluidity. Look at it, thinly plotted, largely themeless, sentimental, and ineluctably trite. The dialogue is poor, or at least violently uneven. The twists are either predictable or sensationalist, and it's always the same beginning and the same ending. My organizational principles, therefore, derive from an inner urgency and from the novelist's addiction to seeing parallels and making connections. The method, plus the use of footnotes to preserve the collateral thought, should give a clear view of the geography of a writer's mind. If the effect sometimes seems staccato, tangential, stop, go, etc., then I can only say that that's what it's like on my side of the desk. And I do it because it has been forced on me. I have seen what perhaps no writer should ever see, the place in the unconscious where my novels come from. I couldn't have stumbled on it unassisted, nor did I. I read about it in the newspaper.
Martin Amis, what do you mean by that last line about reading about it in the newspaper?
I had an affair with a married woman in the mid-70s, and she later led me to understand that that the daughter, the two-year-old daughter she had, was in fact mine. And I believed her because I took the photograph she gave me of this little girl to my mother and said, "What do you think, Mom?" And she held it, the photograph, at various distances from her eyes and then said, without looking up, "Definitely." When this became public 20 years later, 18 years later, there was a great deal about it in the newspapers. And the novelist Maureen Duffy wrote a piece saying that if you look at my novels, you can see that from this date on, in the mid-70s, my novels became quietly obsessed with missing children, threatened children, misattributed children, vulnerable children. And when I read it, I felt completely defeated by this piece. I thought, I felt, as it were, busted by this piece. It seemed to me self-evidently true. And no novelist, you know, you don't, what you write about comes from what's at the back of your mind, not at its forefront. You write about what you, the things you don't know you're worrying about. And it was clear to me that that I had been worrying about her, thinking about her. And I was consoled, in fact, because it meant that I had, in the deepest way possible for me, had been with her in spirit far more than I knew. But it was a great shock to have your unconscious laid out before you like that.
Were you grateful to the reviewer for pointing this out to you?
It goes beyond gratitude. It's or distress. It was just something unanswerable, and it was only actually half the picture because I realized also that I'd been worrying about someone else. In 1973, a few weeks after my first novel was published, in fact, my cousin, my mother's sister's child, disappeared. And for 21 years, no one knew what had happened to her. And then it was revealed round about the same time as the identity of my daughter, and when I came to meet my daughter, that she had been murdered and her body had been exhumed from the basement of Frederick West's house in Gloucester, and he being one of the most prolific serial murderers in English history.
It was your missing cousin's body that was found.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the combination of these two events, I realized that this had constituted the silent anxiety at the back of my mind when I wrote all those novels.
Now, do you ever worry that sometimes even the best kind of psychoanalysis of a writer's motivations might be a little reductionist?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all that stuff is zero rudimentary and trite and boring. And I agree with Nabokov, who says that he rejects the whole world of Freud with its vicious embryos spying on the love lives of its parents. No, it's all humiliating and simple, and I would never in a million years go to a psychiatrist. But, you know, some things your body just accepts as true, and this was one of them.
But as the creator of characters, are you interested in psychological explanations or explorations of their character?
Well, I think I wrote somewhere that, you know, if you're a moralist, and I said this kind of ironically, I said, if you're a moralist, you can't go too far back in anyone's past, no matter how atrocious they are, as people, because if you do, then, and this would be a terrible journey, you know, in a terrible bus with terrible stops for terrible snacks, and you go back on this journey back into their past, and then you would find the justification for their wrongdoing, and everything would be understood, and everything would therefore be forgiven in a way. And if you're a moralist, you can't do that. I'm not a moralist, in a sense, although every writer must be. What I mean is that you can't accuse anyone of anything if you go back far enough, because all is explained.
Martin Amis is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Experience. You say in your memoir that you've said in the past that the present phase of Western literature is higher autobiography, intensely self-inspecting, and that this phase began with confessionalism in American poetry. And you say, we're in this phase where it's no more stories. The author is increasingly committed to the private being. Have you thought of this as a bad thing? I mean, that sounds like a pretty critical way of looking at autobiography or autobiographical fiction, and now you've written a memoir.
I'm suspicious of it, and I don't like the emphasis on the personality. But I'm also susceptible to it, and I feel the same stirrings, as I said, as everyone else. You know, I wrote this book because I came across a natural break in my life. And I always knew I'd have to write about my father in a kind of pro bono spirit because of the, I say modestly, rarity, but in fact uniqueness of our case. I've always had difficulty keeping myself, stopping myself from intervening between my novels and my readers. There's too much me already, and now I'm adding to that. But I still felt I had no choice and I had to do it.
Do you feel you couldn't have written a memoir if your father was still alive, or just that you wouldn't have wanted to?
I wouldn't have wanted to. No, it was always going to be posthumous where he was concerned. It would have been embarrassing. I mean, I couldn't have faced him over the dinner table if I was writing about him while he was alive.
What were your father's roles? And by the way, my guess is Martin Amis, and his father is the late writer Kingsley Amis. What was your father's roles about speaking of or writing about family, speaking of family in public or writing about them?
I don't think he had rules. I don't think he or I had rules. I think you're guided by your instinct and your sensitivity. There's no point in having rules in the publicity age where the rules are broken by others, you know, every day. It would be, you know, frigid and meaningless to just step back from this. So he talked actually often mischievously to the press about me, for instance, and would be quite scathing about the next generation of writers. In his memoirs, he tended to stay away from personal things, but his novels, as I, you know, came to understand, were not autobiographical, but they were about how he was feeling. You know, it's like a damage report or a thermometer reading to read someone's novels. You see what the state of their spirit, and that's evident, you know, throughout his corpus.
Your father wrote a memoir. What was in it about you? Did you read the book to learn more about how he felt about you?
No, of course, I wrenched it open and looked at the index first to see where I appeared. No, I make little walk-on appearances in his memoirs. But he called that book an allography, i.e. writing about others, and steered clear of personal stuff, I think, to preserve it for the fiction.
Now, you say that your father was always honest about his literary opinions, and one of the things he said about you that's been quoted a lot is that you had a terrible compulsive vividness in your style. He said he can't even finish reading your novels, and, quote, it goes back to one of Martin's heroes, Nabokov. I lay it all at his door, that constant demonstrating of his command of English. What was your reaction when you read that? I mean, on the one hand, your father felt he needed to always be honest about his feelings about books. On the other hand, he could have spared you by saying that he's your father and not your reviewer, and he doesn't have to offer public opinions about your writing.
But he was incapable of fudging an opinion when it came to writing. And I always knew that about him and understood that about him. He thought, basically, and he made it clear to me, too, privately, he said, you know, I think you're the best of a bad lot.
That's high praise.
Yeah, well, it is. And actually, at the highest praise he ever, when we were talking about the rarity of our case, he said, a father and son who are both some good, he said. But I was very moved to hear that, because that was high praise coming from him. But the big difference between him and me is that he was a poet as well as a novelist, and I'm just a novelist. So that all the things that you might reserve for your poetry, in his case, all his thoughts about the spirit and the soul, and intense and careful use of words, all that goes into my prose because there's no other channel for it. And that really is the central difference between us.
My guest is Martin Amis. His new memoir is called Experience. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Amis, and he's written a new memoir called Experience, and the book is in part about his father, the late writer Kingsley Amis. Your father had a lot of phobias, including fear of being alone, fear of heights. What were some of the other driving phobias?
Flying, trains, lifts. No, he had a rich array of phobias, which I haven't inherited so far.
Have not?
Have not.
Yeah. It's funny that a man with such strong opinions would be so timid when facing a train or or just being alone.
I know, and I was thinking back the other day to being in New York. We spent a year in America when I was a child, when I was 9, and we came to New York for the day and went up to the top of the Empire State Building. And I was in awe of this great glittering immensity beneath me, and was very puzzled when my mother said, or my father said, actually, on this occasion, he said that it was only the presence of his children that stopped him from screaming when he was on top of the Empire State Building. It was puzzling and a bit disturbing, but the great thing about parents and children, if all is well in the heart, is that you completely accept them. And you give it a minute's thought, and then you just accept it. You just accept your parents. You accept your children. That's the key to it.
You know, another thing I find so paradoxical about your father's phobias is that he's somebody who appears to have been so critical of other people and yet so needy for them.
Is that a contradiction? I think it's all of a piece, don't you? The fact that you need people around might build up a certain kind of resentment at your own weakness.
But what about at their own weaknesses? I mean, it was other people who were so critical of.
Well, he was critical in his letters and utterances. What would you have him do? We prize our writers for their candor. I wouldn't want him any. I wouldn't, you know, he didn't get on with my stuff particularly, but I wouldn't want him to fudge it and pretend that he did. That's what writers are for, to tell the truth as they see it.
How old were you when your parents divorced?
13.
You write a little bit about their divorce, and then you write about your own divorce when you were, what, in your early 40s?
Yes, mid-40s.
And you say that your father wrote that stopping being married to someone is an incredibly violent thing to let happen to you. And you thought about that a lot during your divorce. Were your circumstances similar? Did you both each leave your wives or vice versa? Or?
Well, in fact, I don't write very much at all about my own divorce, don't really want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. One of the great subjects of the novel has been marriage, and what I have to say about the process of being divorced will go to the back of my mind, and I'll worry about it, and in a few years I'll write a novel that will have something to do with it. You select your material when you're writing something like this by thinking about the feelings of others, and I know my ex-wife wouldn't want me to write about it, and that was enough for me, having felt that, I didn't want to write about it either.
Oh, fair enough. Another thing you do say in your memoir is that only to your father could you confess how terrible you felt, how physically terrible, bemused, subnormalized, stupefied from within during this period of divorce. Only to him could I talk about what I was doing to my children because he had done it to me. Could you talk a little bit about if he was helpful to you, if you were able to talk with him about your feelings about his divorce and...
Yeah, that was... I mean, it seems to me that the real violence of divorce is what you are doing to your children. And what that is, simply put, is making them distrustful of love, making them think, well, you'd better not love anyone utterly because things can change. And that's their first lesson in the fragility of love. And, you know, they're going to get that lesson in the end anyway, but it's an awful thing to inflict it on them. And my father, I could talk about it with my father, and he was in his 70s and, in fact, you know, only had two or three more years to live. But he really stirred himself and was a great friend to me during that time. And he used to say, talk as much about it as you want or as little about it as you want. And that was his last fatherly duty to me. He rounded the circle. He had done the same to me. He had made me distrustful of love and perhaps weakened my capacity to love. But he repaired it, you know, in as much as he could in his last years. It was his last fatherly duty.
Martin Amis. He'll be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called Experience. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Inc.'s Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Protecting the Gift, A Parent's Guide to Keeping Children and Teenagers Safe by Gavin DeBecker. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Martin Amis talks about the death of his father, the writer Kingsley Amis. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by two performers, singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves and guitarist Gerf Morlix. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with British novelist Martin Amis, author of Money and the bestsellers London Fields and The Information. He's written a new memoir about being a writer who is the son of a famous writer. His father, Kingsley Amis, is best known for the novel Lucky Jim and for his caustic wit. He was knighted in 1990, 5 years before his death. You write about your mother, that your mother had a breakdown in 1963, which culminated in an accidental overdose of sleeping pills. She said she had been depressed because she was still in love with your father. You say in 1995 your mother was still contemplating death as an escape from her feelings about your father, but an escape in the opposite direction. What do you mean?
Well, she said, my parents divorced, my mother remarried, and then remarried again, my father remarried. And then when his second wife left him, they set up a kind of ménage where my mother and her third husband, to whom she's still very happily married, moved in and kind of looked after my father and acted as housekeepers for him. My father was always difficult and later on was impossible and later on than that was unbelievable. And my mother, blowing the hair off her forehead, would say, I've been dying for a heart attack for years because looking after Kingsley was such hard work. So that's what I meant by escaping in the opposite direction.
That's a really surprising relationship. I'm almost surprised she was willing to do that.
She didn't have a choice, really. It was forced on her because she and her husband had very little money, and my father had money but needed people. So my brother and I kind of, thought this was an obvious, if temporary, solution. We thought it might last 6 months. In fact, it lasted for 12 years and until his death. The weird arrangements for weird people. They were always bohemians, and so a bohemian solution was the good one.
So he paid your mother to take care of him and live in the house.
That's right. Yeah, with my mother, they had the garden flat below. My mother, stepfather, and my half brother, little Jaime, and Kingsley had the floor above, and they had a communal floor above that. And somehow it worked.
Well, it made it easier for you to visit both your parents at the same time.
it was very good for the children. It killed two birds with one stone in all sorts of senses.
Martin Amis is my guest. He's a novelist who's written a new memoir called Experience. Your father, the writer Kingsley Amis, lost much of his memory before he died. Your father was so much about memory being transformed into fiction. And I'm sure you thought a lot about the meaning of memory, watching your father lose his and lose certain words in the process, too.
Oh, no, it was very much the losing of the words was even more dramatic, and losing humor. And that was the truly devastating thing about his death was that... he has a character say in one of his novels, the rewards of being sane are not many, but knowing what's funny is one of them. And he didn't, towards the end of his, in his last months, he didn't know what was funny. He couldn't find words. It was all closing down, the whole operation. The great engine of comedy that he'd been was winding down. And it was like something out of a novel, in that it measured up. It had symmetry. That here was this man whose whole life had been devoted to words and their comic possibilities, and he'd become a kind of anti-Kingsley. After he died, and in his last months, as I say, he was reduced to commonplaces and tautologies and the simplest forms of communication. After he died, I was given a typescript of a book he'd written in his last year or so called The King's English, which is about language and grammar and usage. And it almost gave me a heart attack because here was my father's voice again. And in fact, it's one of his best books. It's almost a memoir in itself about his love of language and the ways language can make you laugh. And it was published posthumously.
There are so many parallels between your life and your father's life, in part because he was a writer, you're a writer. What did his death after the loss of so much memory make you think about facing your own death and possibly, you know, being so transformed in the process, transformed like he was?
Chiefly terror, of course.
Right.
And every time I, you know, stumble over a word or can't remember how to spell something, I think it's starting. Parents, this is particularly true perhaps of fathers and sons, I mean, they teach you not with catechisms or, you know, little lessons. They teach you by example, and they even, as it turns out, teach you how to die. I think Socrates said the task of philosophy is learning how to die. A big lesson in that is sitting beside your father's hospital bed and watching him do it.
Well, what about the way he did it made you feel that he was teaching you something by example that you wanted to know?
His great friend, the poet Philip Larkin, said, another death-obsessed writer, said that being brave while you die means not scaring others. And, you know, I think that was the great lesson. My father had not much control over what his behavior and the things he said as he was dying, but he did a pretty good job of not scaring his children. There were some very alarming moments and always great suspense when you went to see him during those weeks. But he somehow managed that and died well.
But I think one of the scary things is just watching somebody be so transformed before death, watching them be a different person because they don't have memory anymore. That's scary enough.
Oh, it's very scary. And one of the hospitals he was at, the door to his room had a little glass window set into it. And I, like all his visitors, I'm sure, would peer in through that glass as if at a TV screen to get a kind of a trailer of what lay in store for you, because, you know, you had absolutely no idea what was going to happen in the during your visit. And you would take a deep breath and in you would go. But again, as I said earlier, it's acceptance is what marks the filial and parental relationship. And so even in extremis, you would accept it.
When your father was dying, you say that you told yourself what you'd always told yourself. It's what all writers have always told themselves, consciously or otherwise. The things you feel are universal. Now, did that remind you to yourself that the things you were feeling were universal? Was that an attempt to help you deal with your feelings, knowing that they were universal? Or is that more about writing what you were feeling, feeling that...
No, it was a moral worry, really, because... the death of the father is a complex event. It's not just, you know, feeling sad, and I described the feeling when I was told by my mother that he was going to die, because till quite late on, we thought he would persist in a sort of damaged way for some years. And it felt like I was about to levitate, a sense of impending levitation, rise up off the ground. But in fact, that's expressive and, again, a complex reaction, because you're coming into your own when your father dies. Of course you want him to live forever. And I can boast, and my brother and sister can boast, that we had no regrets when he died. We wanted him to live forever, but we'd had our time with him. We'd said the words to him. There was nothing left unsaid. There were no bitternesses. So it was all, that was all clear. But to bring in Freud and his vicious embryos again, Freud says that the death of the father makes, it's partly chemical, I suppose, but floods you with endorphins and to get you through the experience. And you feel full of energy and ready for work. And, you know, there are books to be written, there are children to be raised. It's only afterwards that you get, you know, for the rest of your life, you are repairing the damage done, the grief inflicted by the loss of the father. It's, you lose a part of yourself and you never get over that. But the actual business of the father dying is not a simple one of grief. It's, you feel this guilty energy and a sort of spring in your step, because you're stepping forward, you're evolving, you're going on to the next stage.
My guest is Martin Amis. His new memoir is called Experience. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Martin Amis, who's written a new memoir, which is called Experience, and the book is in part about his relationship to his father, the late writer Kingsley Amis. You say in your memoir, "I used to give the midlife crisis little credit and no respect. It was the preserve of various dunces and weaklings." So what was your midlife crisis about?
Don't ask.
I think I just did.
Well, the midlife crisis is something you ought to have, I think. It is critical to have a midlife crisis, and if you don't have one, then that's a crisis. It's facing up to all sorts of structural things in your life that haven't yet been faced, and chief among them is a new alignment, a new accession to death. I say that youth can perhaps be defined, and you see it in the very young, everywhere you look, as a sense of immortality, invulnerability. That's why the young are fearless, because they can't believe in their own death. They're not scheduled to believe in it. But when you get to around 40, it's a full-time job looking the other way, and you have to turn and look away from this fake, illusory immortality, and you have to turn your head and look at mortality. And you ought to have a crisis about that.
What kind of change in behavior did that lead you to?
Well, in my case, it involved the breakup of my marriage, a health crisis having to do with my teeth, and it also involved, included death of the father. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty thoroughgoing.
The health crisis you referred to had to do with your teeth, abscesses, I think a tumor that they found.
Yeah.
A lot of pain over a long period of time, a lot of complex dental surgery and teeth replacement and so on. Pain in the mouth is a very central location for pain. It's hard to distract yourself when you have pain in your mouth.
That's where you live.
It's where you live. It's where you speak. It's where you eat. It's where you kiss. It's where you breathe sometimes.
Indeed. And in fact, they made a model of the human body entirely scaled to nerve ends. And the result was an incredible little midget with an enormous Mick Jagger mouth. No, it is, if something's going on in there, then that's where you live. And, you know, that's partly what I meant by facing up to things you haven't faced, because I had, you know, ceased to go to the dentist. I'd let it become a kind of complex and an obsession. And, you know, dealing with that was certainly part of my crisis.
What did you figure out about things that you could do that you were capable of doing with pain, and things that were just impossible to even consider when you were in pain?
Pain was always, you know, the toothache is the kind of civilian limit of pain, and I just howled my way through that. But what I hated more was the fact that I'd have to do something about it.
Do you think you became very unpleasant when you were in a lot of pain?
Did I become unpleasant?
Uh-huh. I think it's easy to be unpleasant when you're very uncomfortable.
Well, Sam Johnson said it is so very difficult for a sick man not to be a scoundrel. Quoted by Brenda Maddox in her Life of D.H. Lawrence, D.H. Lawrence perhaps being the worst behaved writer of all time, and there's a lot in that. You know, he never took a breath without pain and without an intimation of mortality, and died at 44. It is difficult for a sick man not to be a scoundrel, but I don't think. It made me feel, actually, on the contrary, I kept thinking, Christ, I've got to start being nice to people. It had more that effect, because you need them. You need their sympathy.
Right. I want to get back to something you mentioned at the beginning of our talk, which you write about some in the book, and that is that you found out that you had fathered somebody who you were in a relationship with years ago, and I think you said the child was two when you found out.
Yes.
But the story was made public about 18 years later. What kind of relationship, if any, did you decide to have with the daughter that you found out after the fact that you fathered?
I didn't decide to have a relationship. We met and fell in love. And I have a wonderfully warm and candid relationship with her, Delilah, and it's been not just easy, but wonderful. And I, when her other father wrote to me saying that Delilah now knows that I'm not her father and that you are, I said, I was very shocked by the letter, because I realized, as he said, it's been in the back of your mind, no doubt, and that's exactly where it had been. But I said to my wife, I showed her the letter, and she read it, and I said, there's absolutely no reason, is there, why this shouldn't be a wonderful thing? And she said straight away, none. And, you know, she was a key figure, my wife, and Delilah's other father, Patrick, was a key figure. And you can imagine all sorts of things that might have gone wrong in the periphery there. But our relationship has just been, you know, a warm breeze. And, love flowed and was soon declared. And you know, why would it not?
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Martin Amis has written a new memoir called Experience. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves and a new CD by guitarist Gerf Morlix, who produced Cleaves' recording. This is Fresh Air. The folk-based singer-songwriter is not often rock critic Ken Tucker's favorite genre, but he's found a performer he likes that fits this description, Slade Cleaves, whose new album is produced by Gerf Morlix, who also produced Lucinda Williams, Jimmy Dale Gilmour, and Alejandro Escovedo. As it happens, Morlix has his own debut CD just out. Ken reviews them both.
Sherry had a pawn shop bound of gold, a sink full of dishes and a love grown cold. Long came a boy, pretty as the devil. She took his hand, the whole thing unraveled. There's no turning round, it's broke down.
That's Broke Down, the title song from Slade Cleaves' new CD. Cleaves has a warm, reedy voice, and on different songs, he can remind you of James Taylor or Loudon Wainwright or Tom Paxton. There's nothing revolutionary or groundbreaking about Slade Cleaves' music, it's just awfully well-played and well-crafted. Even when he's being downbeat on a song like One Good Year, Cleaves makes you feel good about his misery.
It's a New Year's Day, just like the day before. Same old skies of gray, same empty bottles on the floor. Another year gone by, and I'm thinking once again, how can I take this losing hand and somehow win? Just give me one good year.
There's no doubt that one reason Slade Cleaves' CD is as compelling as it is due to the production work by Gerf Morlix. Morlix often provides a strong spine to a song, keeping the melody upright and prominent, and adding extra musical muscle to Cleaves' acoustic guitar. Morlix has proved he knows how to offer subtle, unostentatious support to records like Lucinda Williams' Sweet Old World and Buddy Miller's Your Love and Other Lies, and he does the same thing on his own CD, which is called Toad of Titicaca.
Such an easy game to play. I made some mistakes, I learned my lesson, and I blunder on. I blunder
on. Throughout Morlix's album, he portrays himself as a genial screw-up who, as he says there, keeps blundering on. Like a lot of producers-turned-performers, he doesn't have a great singing voice, but what he has is more than enough to put across his tales of broken-hearted woe. And it's a perfectly good voice with which to deliver a good deadpan joke like this song called Dan Blocker. Yep, the big man who used to star in the 60s TV show Bonanza.
Dan Blocker, Lorne
like the land in Parnell, Roberts, Dan, Blocker, Dan, Blocker, Lorne, Green, like the land in Parnell, Roberts, Dan, Blocker.
I'll bet somewhere in heaven Michael Landon is jealous. Neither Slade Cleaves nor Gerf Morlix, certainly two of the most interesting names I've had to pronounce in one review that I can recall, is destined for great stardom. But who cares, except maybe them. Their small, carefully delineated charms are modest pleasures that are all the more valuable in the often overblown, excessively ambitious musical worlds they travel in. Far from blundering on, they are proceeding with unusual grace.
Ken Tucker as critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
1, 2, 3. I had plenty of keys on my key ring. A beautiful home. With a loving wife and a car to drive, I came home from work every day at 5. One by one, started losing them keys. My darling wife, I just couldn't please. My boss got on my nerves one day. I knew that I was on my way. I lost my wife, I lost my hope, quit my job and set out.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of 101 Ways by Mako Yoshikawa. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Arthur Sulzberger Jr., publisher of the New York Times. And we meet the Times word czar, Alan Siegel, who co-wrote the paper's new style and usage manual. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.